As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
You should celebrate yourself every day, but some days you should celebrate with jewelry. Whether you want to commemorate an unforgettable moment or just bring some added sparkle to your collection, Blue Nile can offer you expert guidance and a wide assortment of jewelry of the highest quality at the best price. Go to BlueNile.com today and experience the ease and convenience of shopping Blue Nile, the original online jeweler since 1999. That's BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
This is a podcast from The Times, sports newspaper of the year.
Can you put your hands together, please, for the host of the game podcast, Gabriele Marcotti.
Welcome to a live edition of The Game, and we're here in front of a studio audience. We're very excited, obviously, and we're just glad that you guys came and joined us on this rather muggy late May evening. I'm Gabriele Marcotti, and I'm talking to you from the Freemasons Arms in Covent Garden in London. You may be wondering, why are we doing this from a random pub in London? Is it just because we wanted to get Tony Cascarino and Tony Evans out? No. This is quite significant because it was here that in 1863, nearly, 150 years ago, the Football Association was founded. That, of course, would be the English Football Association, but, of course, we don't say that. It's a bit like the Open, so it's just the Football Association. So thanks for meeting in this club, in this pub, rather. Association football and rugby football went their separate ways, allowing us to experience the offside, the FA Cup, Mark Palios, Super Wembley Stadium, international football, and the formation of other FAs around the world, like the Italian FA, which of course was put together just 35 years later. But of course we did go on to win four World Cups, so there. With Euro 2012 ahead of us, we're going to be looking at England's prospects, as well as the state of the game in general, and also our own alternative to penalty shootouts. Our producer, Chris Skinner, just threw it out to a bunch of you. Hopefully we'll get some useful ones. Not that Sepp Blatter will listen to us, but hey. But anyway, I'm not a priest. I'm not here to lecture you or educate you, although I do have some of my finest cohorts from The Times. And first of all, my boss, The Times football editor, and of course, well-known resident Manchester United fan, it's Tony Evans.
Hey, everyone. How are you tonight?
As you can tell, he is a mank through and through. We also join with us by The Times chief football correspondent and occasional Darth Vader impersonator, it's Mr. Ollie Kay. And no, see, Ollie, that says Cass. This says Ollie.
Okay, it's very small.
Can I just say what a treat it is to have Ollie here in person? Normally, he's just a faraway voice.
Yeah.
Up in Rippendon. We also have a man who writes, I think, fascinating and insightful pieces for The Times, and also a guy who earned, 80 caps for the Republic of Ireland? It's Tony Cascarino.
Illegally.
Thank you.
So what was that?
Illegally.
See, how many of those did you actually play 90 minutes?
Two. No, I played 88 times, Gab.
88? I think Skinner is wrong. Skinner's putting you down.
No, 88. I think I held the record for the most substitute appearances to come on.
Wow.
Yeah, I think I do. Someone told me that one day.
Game changer.
Sorry?
Game changer.
Oh. There you go. All right, so let's start by getting a state of play from the audience. It's a clever device that Skinner dreamed up. I'm going to make some statements. If you agree, say yes or make some noise somehow. If you don't agree, please stay silent. England will win Euro 2012.
No.
Not a single person here believes England will win Euro 2012.
I don't think you can write them over completely. You know, Greece won it. In seriousness, I think everyone will probably know I'm not a Roy Hodgson fan, but this squad is a very Hodgson squad, you know, and it will allow him to do the things he does really well. And what he's really good at is neutralising the opposition's qualities. He's not so good with flair himself. I can see them with two banks of four. I can see them going a long way. They'll get to the quarterfinals. You get a bit of luck. You never know.
You never know. Well, next one might be in the you never know category as well. The Republic of Ireland to win the Euros.
More chance.
There you go. Slightly more chance than England, right? Haters. Spain to win the Euros?
Yeah.
How about this one? Germany to win the Euros.
Yeah.
All right. England to make it through the group stage.
Yes.
England to go out on penalties.
Yes.
Wayne Rooney to get sent off on his first appearance. This is mean. Skinner wrote this. How about this one? Manchester City deserve to be crowned Premier League champions.
Yes.
And finally, Chelsea deserve to win the Champions League title. All right, but let's move on with our topics. Now, these were all selected by you, so if they suck, complain to each other. We will try to bring you in wherever we can. So if you have something to say, you know, raise your hand, get some attention. I'll try to call for you. One thing I do ask is we've got Olivia and Skinner out there with microphones, and just obviously wait for the guy to come to you, because while I can probably hear you, remember, we're also recording this for our millions of listeners worldwide. Now, first off, we're talking England, we're talking Euro 2012, and this was inspired by questions from Jermaine George. Jermaine, you here? There you go. And Graham Carter. We acknowledge Graham? Graham in the back. We've sort of merged these into one, but here's a good one for Ollie to start with. This is Jermaine's question. I would like the panel to discuss the real reasoning behind the exclusion of Rio Ferdinand, the exclusion of Aaron Lennon, and Micah Richards, as well as Daniel Sturridge.
Well, what do you think is the real reason?
He's deflecting. He's trying to take a politician.
Because the phrase "the real reasoning" implies that maybe it's not as described.
My opinion is, where do I start, really? I'll start with Aaron Lennon. I believe one of the main reasons that Tottenham lost the Champions League qualification for next season, other than Chelsea, was Aaron Lennon was injured. Mm. So I don't believe Stuart Downing should be there. But secondly, Micah Richards, fantastic fullback, strong in the air, good going forward, overlapping defender, can provide options, pace. He should be there, or at least have been on the five. Rio Ferdinand, well, I mean, I'm a Man United fan, so perhaps there might be some bias there, but I just believe that experience, you know, now he's taken Jagielka there. United didn't have that bad a season. They finished level on points with the champions, so surely he's done something right. And what do you think?
Do I take the microphone? No,
your mic's up. That's the thing that you put on you. It's called a mic. He can't read. And he doesn't know where a mic is.
That's good.
Yeah, I made him football correspondent at the Times. So that makes me the Thomas Pearson on this panel.
When Tony was talking about it being a Roy Hodgson-style squad and being, you know, maybe not full of flair, I think there's a certain Roy Hodgson type of player, and there are similarly players who aren't a Roy Hodgson type. When you look at a player like Richards and a player like Lennon, who are all about pace and sort of unbridled athleticism, I don't think they are the type of players who Hodgson would want to build his squad around. I'm surprised that he hasn't got Richards in the squad at all, particularly with Kyle Walker out. But when I was the day after Hodgson was appointed, I was asked to sort of cobble together what I thought would be Hodgson's squad, and it didn't have either of those two in it because I just didn't see them as Hodgson type players, because he likes the sort of very diligent, obedient James Milner type, or the Stuart Downing type, Phil Jones type, etc. Rio Ferdinand, I agree with you. I think he's had a very good season. Some bad games where he's had Jones alongside him or whatever, but I would have had him in my squad. But there's the undoubted issue there with him and John Terry, and Hodgson talks about football reasons for leaving him out. I think the football reasons are that he can't have the two of them in the same squad because they can't stand the sight of each other.
So they're not really football reasons?
Well, it becomes related to football because it becomes a football consideration if you can't have two guys like that.
What
in
I don't
squad.
Get is, has John Terry ever said he couldn't play with Rio Ferdinand? And has Rio ever come out and said that about JT?
Well, apparently they were both asked and both indicated that they would be willing to, but...
What people say in public and what they say in private is very different. I'll tell you what, there's an alternative view of this, that it makes dressing room politics a lot easier, doesn't it? You know, and the fact is, including John Terry, was going to cause a rift in that squad. And the rift would have been deeper had he included the players that he's left out. Like you, I'm a cynic about this. I think it's more to do with dressing room politics than actually picking the best squad, although Ollie has a point that Roy Hodgson doesn't like players who get up the pitch and down the pitch and don't stay where he tells them. But I do think there is a rather cynical level to this where, frankly, he didn't want too many black players in the squad with John Terry.
Well, Cass, on that point, in terms of guys working together, I remember Manchester United winning a treble with Andy Cole and Teddy Sheringham, both on the same team. I'm asking this because, for those who don't know, Tony and Teddy Sheringham are extremely tight and have been
the Marys
for a long, long time.
The Marys.
He's lived off my name for so long.
But viewed from the outside, it looked to me like it wasn't a problem for those two guys on the pitch. But did it take an uber god of a manager like Sir Alex Ferguson to make it work? And was it too big of an ask for Roy Hodgson?
It's really difficult, Gab, because there was a player in that dressing room at Manchester United who dominated, and everybody knows him as Roy Keane. Okay, I remember chatting to him on the beach in Ireland. We had an international game, and I was walking along talking to Ryan about, you know, his fallouts at the club, and he said, "I go in a Monday morning."
Do his accent.
I can't. He said, "I go in on a Monday morning." He said, "And I can't remember how many are not talking to me." He said, "I've fallen out with so many. It was Schmeichel, it was Pallister, it was Sheringham. There was about five or six." And it happens. And it you know, clicks in dressing room, that is part and parcel of the game. You work in your offices, environments, that's part of life. Tony touched on, we had a chat, didn't we, Tony, beforehand? I said to Tony, I said to Tony, "Is it a coincidence that there's four black players being left out? Is it me? I don't know. Is it me?" I said, because Rio is friends with all of, you know, Micah Richards is a Man City, Manchester lad. Daniel Sturridge was playing at Manchester City. Now, I'm being ultra cynical like Tony, but I do think there was a harmony thing. I think Roy Hodgson, of course he's not being racist for leaving them out, but I think there was a harmony thing, and I really believe that, you know, you do get cliques, you do get groups of lads. Doesn't mean you're wanting not to welcome people in, but it does happen. And I think he felt, if I'm not picking Rio, I don't know if I'm going to pick these other ones. Now, you can say Theo's in there and who else? Jermaine Defoe.
Ashley Young.
Yeah, Ashley Young. But I just felt there was something strange about it.
The implication of what you're saying is that, and I find this extraordinary, that Roy Hodgson or, you know, maybe Alex Horn or God knows who actually sat there and said...
No, he didn't,
okay,
Gab.
Is Ashley Young going to be more upset than Micah Richards about... I mean...
No, Gab, I felt it was a bit deeper than that. I did feel it's a bit deeper. I think he's looking for total harmony. That's more the point.
Now, that would be a reason to not call up Daniel Sturridge, regardless of what colour or heritage he was.
Well, I don't know. I don't think there's a conscious decision there.
But I think it's, you know, what would be the most harmonious dressing room I can take through this tournament? You know, it's... So I don't know. Well, I mean, what's the view of the audience?
The audience, yeah.
I mean, just say, you know, if you believe in Ollie's version of it, and which is, you know, quite reasonable. And Hodgson, being sensible, say aye.
Aye.
If you're a cynic like me and Tony, no.
But the thing with, if we talk about why isn't Lennon in the squad, why isn't Sturgeon in the squad, why isn't Richards in the squad?
Rio's head and shoulders, he should have been in the squad.
Rio is, but Rio wasn't even getting picked by Capello. And that goes back to the sort of political issue with John Terry as well. But if we're talking about Lennon, Richards, Sturridge, the three of them weren't playing an awful lot in the final months of the season when Hodgson's mind probably started to turn to England.
Nor was Andy Carroll.
Well, the final
months. Well, the last six weeks of the season, really.
I know, but it's only the final weeks of the season that Hodgson's mind turned to England, so he probably starts. So he wasn't going to pick Daniel Sturridge on the basis of what he did in December in the odd Champions League group game.
Well, I want to ask you on this point, somebody like Sturridge, would actually the fact that people have seen what he can do, he can obviously score goals. I think some managers and some people feel that he's difficult to place in a side and he's got a really bad attitude, but that said, he's somebody who I would expect to be 100% fresh at this stage of the season, unlike, you know, Rooney or some of the City players who will be perhaps worn down or Lampard. Does that come into Hodgson's mind at all? Would it have considered that, hey, if I play Sturridge, I've got a guy who's basically going to be totally fresh because he hasn't played very much? And also, could you also address somebody like Jagielka, who hasn't played much because he was injured? Why is he going?
I think Jagielka's going because there are so many defenders or so many people unavailable. But it was interesting that Jagielka was the one who got summoned from the standby list rather than Jordan Henderson once Gareth Barry dropped out. And that, to me, suggested a lack of faith in Phil Jones as a central defender, which is a different issue completely.
Well, you have a question there in the back of the room.
Yeah, hi. There are a number of grumbles following Roy Hodgson's announcement of his 22 for the championships. Who would you have taken instead with a view to the World Cup in 2014?
All right, that was Graham Carter, of course, was one of the people who submitted our questions. Cass, I want to start with you because I know it's going to take Tony and Ollie a few minutes to straighten out their thoughts. But if you could replace two people from Hodgson's squad with two people of your own choosing and pretend you're an England fan for a minute, who would they be?
Peter Crouch, undoubtedly.
I
think England lack a depth of strikers. I mean, they've chosen three and a half. Rooney is not available for the first two games. So I felt that certainly a striker should have been introduced.
So you drop one of the wingers for another striker, take five
Well,
strikers.
I probably would have dropped Stuart Downing. I would have taken Stuart Downing out, even though I think he's a player that's suffers. I always watch Stuart. Every time I think, watch him, his first touch is good. And I was saying to a couple of lads at the bar that his first touch is good. I think he's going to have a good game. If it's not, I think he's going to have a poor game. And that's
just the one guy? Otherwise, Hodgson's entirely on message with you?
Anybody else, really? I mean,
not Rio?
Nah. Well, Rio. We touched on Rio, yeah.
So you would
think
Rio?
Absolutely, yeah. Rio. I mean, there, you know, if you come second,
Rio
struggled probably between October till December. He looked like he was just not quite right. Yeah. On the end of the season, played a lot better.
Anybody out there, big Peter Crouch by acclamation? Anybody say aye?
Aye.
Oh, there you go. Some support for the big man. Tony, again, for you, it might be a bit more difficult to pretend you're an England fan, but
Stuart Downing, I'd replace him with a training cone.
That settles that.
I would have looked at including Michael Carrick, I think, based on the fact that England have a lot of midfielders who aren't very good at setting a tempo and keeping possession. I would have wondered about the possibility of including Michael Carrick, but then there's the fact that he's, which has only emerged since the squad was named, that Carrick basically withdrew himself from international duty last year sometime.
Is that actually true?
Yeah,
or is that just another lie that Alex Horn put
true.
Out?
what's your problem?
I mean, it's better. I'll pick on him.
Alex Horn wouldn't lie, would he?
No.
No one from the FA would lie.
No, but the
because that doesn't match what I've heard from... you can guess.
Yeah, I can. But the...
Has Carrick actually said that? I ruled myself out of England duty a year ago.
Well, he hasn't then, but he hasn't stuck his hand up to say that, just he hasn't stuck his hand up to play in the past. So my, although I would have Carrick in the squad if I was picking it with a clean slate and so on, there are a lot of Man United fans who are very upset on Carrick's behalf, and I don't think it's worth anybody getting upset on Carrick's behalf, because he clearly doesn't want to be there if he's not going to be first choice for England, and he's not done enough in the past to be first choice. But I would have wished that he could at least be willing to be in the squad.
Don't you think he'd just be another England midfielder who doesn't set the tempo and doesn't keep possession?
Well, I think he does. I think he does those things. I think he sets the tempo, keeps the tempo, and keeps possession. I don't think he necessarily
dominates
games.
Does he do it well enough to play
games.
International football? I don't think he does it well enough to.
I think in the games where England have been overrun in midfield and where they've frittered away possession an awful lot in the past, I think those are games where you could do with a Michael Carrick type.
Mm. So on that issue, after Parker gets injured or sent off, who...
For two flying handballs.
Exactly. Does Jagielka play in central midfield at that point? What was the logic here with not... I know Henderson is Jordan Henderson, but... This is a body who plays in central midfield. Well, what's the thinking there? What's he going to do?
I think they're going to start with Parker and Gerrard in central midfield, with Lampard the next one to come in. And
so we could see another Lampard-Gerrard central midfield after Parker gets sent off.
Could. Might work this day.
Really? You're not serious. You're not joking. See, Lampard and Gerrard in central midfield.
See, if Hodgson had any sort of creative thought, was thinking outside his box, he'd shift Gerrard out to the right, and he'd play Parker. And then he could even play Lampard in the inside left channel going down. And, Lampard, after all, scores, and he still scores goals, but he won't. He'll play the captain in the centre of midfield, where he's, frankly, ineffective most of the time.
Come on, Tony. Gerrard on the right? What club team ever won anything with Gerrard playing on the right-hand side of midfield? There's a bit of a layup there, but okay. One final thing that struck me, and maybe we can get an acclamation, is Hodgson obviously comes in. He doesn't have time to prepare. He doesn't have time to scout people. Doesn't have time to build relationships with the players. I don't think he's ever managed any of these players except for Gerrard.
And Glenn Johnson.
And
that works really well.
Should he be thinking in terms of 2014? Or should he actually be thinking in terms of, I might not be in the job much longer after we lose all three games? And so, no, but I mean, it's a serious question. Should he have thought more about bringing more kids into the team rather than this Lampard and all these veterans?
I think he's in a fantastic position that expectation is very, very low, where they're going into a tournament. If it fails and it falls flat on its face, no one's going to really point the finger at Roy Hodgson. He might take some blame, but I think the blame is firmly going to be on the FA, isn't it? They're going to take most of it for the time that he came into the job, the lack of preparation, which has been... I mean, you just wouldn't get it in normal business for so late in the day. So he's got a bit of a free run, Gab. But with that, there's got to be performances that are going to make everybody be lifted. Because what happens... I was lucky enough to be in France when the build-up of the French team happened. And they were given Gerard Houllier when he took the kids and... Everybody was there was a bit of a train ride with the players and the exciting young players that came along, and obviously they're big stars now. But everyone it all gathered momentum, which England hasn't really happened. I'm not sure the English public trust the England team. There's a real lack of trust around the whole system and the team.
But Ollie, wouldn't that have been an argument then? I mean, do we really need to see Jermaine Defoe play for England again? I see the logic with Defoe if you think you're going to win it, but maybe if you have an eye towards the future, maybe you call another young striker? Or do you feel with Oxlade-Chamberlain and whatever else, you've already sort of fulfilled your quota of young players getting experience for the future? I mean, do you think the balance is there, I guess, is what I'm driving at?
Well, I think a lot of people have this perception that the squad hadn't moved on under Campello since the World Cup. And what people kind of overlook is that the squad and the team had changed a lot, because Hart come and go. You've got people like Kyle Walker and Jack Wilshere had come in, and Welbeck and others, Phil Jones, etc. Tom Cleverley was in the squad at one stage. And basically, that kind of refreshing of the squad had happened. And then when a lot of those players, Walker, Wilshere, etc., were injured at the end of the season, you had a lot more of the same old faces in the squad. So that that created a lot of people going, oh, it's just the same old faces. I mean, there aren't many young players out there who are not in the squad, who have made a compelling case to be in the squad. Because if anyone had really made a compelling case, they would have been there.
Every day that goes by, I find myself more and more confused by football and the logic that's out there. I mean, oh, let's build for the future in international football. There's one tournament every 2 years and that's all that matters. Here and now is everything. What you build for? To win a friendly in 18 months. You pick the best players now that you've got and you play them in the tournament. And when the World Cup comes round, you play them there, the best players you've got. You don't take the kids if they're not up to it. Yeah. You know, you play the best people. And the thing is, but the maddest thing of all is to give Hodgson a 4-year contract. It is age. I would give international managers one cycle. I'd give Hodgson a chance, or he's coming at a strange time, to go to the World Cup next time and then reassess it instead of giving these contracts out.
Just to wrap this up, I'm going to throw a final question at Ollie. I'm sorry, Ollie, but today you are the representative of the Football Association here.
Because couldn't get Alex Horn.
What? Sorry?
Couldn't get Alex Horn.
Yeah, I thought you mentioned somebody else's name. As I understand it, Roy Hodgson is going to be far and away the highest paid manager at the Euros. And he has a 4-year deal. This is the part I never get. You're Roy Hodgson, you're in your mid-60s, you've made a lot of money over the years. If your country comes to you and says, hey Roy, come manage England, we'll pay you £500,000 plus another £2 million if you win the Euros, right? Is he going to turn it down? Is he going to turn it down and say, no, because if I'm only making £500,000, what, it's an insult? Or, no, that's not enough for me to manage my country at a major European championship? Do those thoughts go through the FA's mind? Or do they feel that, well, let's see, we paid Capello, what, £5 million, and Roy Hodgson's about 60% is good, so maybe we need to pay him. I mean, is that the logic?
Well, because of that, they think they've got him on the cheap. They think they've got a manager on the cheap.
Do they really believe this?
Yeah, because it's so much
cheaper. And then you're telling me I shouldn't have a go at Alex Horn?
You should.
No. You know, let's face it. You know, all those Scandinavian trophies—they've pushed up the price.
We don't know. Oh, yeah, I don't want to turn this into a mockery of Hodgson because that's where he was managing, and he won the leagues there. But I am curious by this financial thing where we somehow just pay him more, he's going to be better.
Once I realised that, like, you know, we were bringing those sort of leagues into account, I've got me medals up from the five-a-side of Vernon Sangster in Stanley Park.
All right, there's another Merseyside reference. That teases up nicely. We mentioned the money spent to pay Roy Hodgson's wages, and that teases up nicely for our next question, which is to do with financial fair play. And again, Chris Skinner, our producer, collated a bunch of questions for you. And we've got a question from Wayne Eastman. Do the panel think it will have the financial fair play will have the desired impact and make the European leagues more competitive, or is it destined to fail? And should it succeed, which teams in the Premier League are in the best position to benefit from the rule, from the rules, and which teams may find it hard to adapt? Now, on the first part, they have written extensively about this. I'm not sure the purpose of financial fair play is to make the European leagues or European competition more competitive. I think it's simply designed to make sure that most football clubs are profitable. Or at least break even. Anybody want to disagree with that?
I think it's also designed to ring fence the big clubs and to keep them at the highest level in the Champions League, to make sure the television revenues keep coming in. And I think within 10 years of the implementation of financial fair play, next season we'll see a European Super League.
Well, wow, that would be a kind of a scare. Within 10 years?
Within 10 years, yeah.
I'm not sure I quite go that far, but Ollie, the ultimate argument is that this is a way to make sure that the rich stay rich, and you know, clubs like United, who Bayern Munich or Real Madrid, who've got such they'll just forever be able to outspend the little guys. Mm. So why is it called fair play?
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, the interesting thing with that is that it was the conversation started around 2008, and it was all about the sort of dominance of the Champions League by clubs like Manchester United and Chelsea, who reached the final that year, both of which were heavily in debt, as were Liverpool, Liverpool in the semi-final that year, all heavily in debt. And it was basically Michel Platini started saying, you know, debt is the big problem. We need to control debt. Debt is the great evil. And then basically they started this consultation, got the clubs involved. And the club started saying, well, no, debt's not the problem. The problem is people spending beyond their means. So basically you've got an elite of clubs, which is essentially Bayern Munich, AC Milan, Real Madrid, Barcelona, Manchester United, all calling the shots, and it becomes something that, rather than controlling debt, basically stops clubs coming from outside that elite and gate-crushing the elite. And it's basically ended up being something that is designed to keep Manchester City, Paris Saint-Germain, etc. at bay. It protects that elite.
What happened? Tony, your old club, Chelsea, as well, right?
Yeah, well, I mean,
they lose money every year.
How much they spent just recently? I mean, they've just Hazard and the lad from Dortmund. So they've just, you know,
they're Raymond, Marco Marin.
Yeah, they're just spending money. I mean, I just think they'll find loopholes even if they do get controlled, because they've managed to do it in years gone by. So, I mean, what happened in France this year was an extraordinary gap, wasn't it? Where Montpellier winning the French league. I mean, their budget is just, well, it probably be one tenth of what an average Premiership team would be. So I don't see how people can still break down the law. Big clubs have been dominating from day one, well, and will continue. There's too much money. They all go bigger stadiums, don't they? They have benefactors of, you know, people like Abramovich who are pumping money in. They have these extraordinary merchandise deals. There's so much money pumped into them. But that's the thing,
and I think this was kind of the second part of the question that we had today, is certain clubs in the Premier League look like they're miles away from ever fulfilling the criteria. Thinking of Manchester City, obviously, and Chelsea are the two obvious ones.
United are in a magnificent position.
They're laughing.
No, yeah. I mean, you know.
How clever is Malcolm Glazer?
Well,
he gets to take £70 million of the club. He makes a profit every year.
Yeah, and you know, and they've managed to pay off some of the debt. And they've not spent a lot of money. They've increased their incomes massively. And they're going to be in a brilliant situation when they take the reins off in terms of spending. They're going to be as good as anyone in Europe. You know, well,
let me throw this out here before we get to Nick Strong with the other question. Again, by acclamation, you can make noise somehow if you agree with the statement. Is financial fair play, as the laws are written, good for football?
Yes.
Is financial fair play bad for football?
Yeah, very bad for football.
All right, so it seems a majority on the bad. Now, we have our other question here is from Nick Strong. Nick, are you with us? Nick, right there in the back, behind you. Olivia?
Hiya. Basically, do you think the loopholes, which was touched on there, for like sponsorship deals, are just going to see all the way through the sort of designs of financial fair play? Because as a Stoke fan, we've now changed to Bet365 on the shirts, which is Peter Coates' company. And even for myself, that seems a bit like coincidence that it's suddenly happening now when these rules are imminent.
Well, it's happened with Newcastle, hasn't it? You know.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts. Calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Life is full of awesome what ifs, and some not so much, like unexpected medical costs. That's why United Healthcare provides Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans to supplement your primary plan and help manage out of pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Etihad.
Well, no, because he's not putting any money in it.
No, but they're still using, the company is still giving the money.
No, but
to the
what
club.
I'm saying is Peter Coates is putting money in via Bet365.
Yes.
Actually, it's free advertising.
Exactly.
Yeah, but hasn't he charged the club? I thought he charged the club as well for using Bet Direct. He's paying basically the same person. Yeah?
Who?
Do you understand what I'm saying?
But when it comes to betting and stuff, you're the expert here, not me.
I think in a roundabout way, Bet Direct are paying into the Newcastle pot.
Bet Direct is another Ashley company.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I don't understand. I'm getting myself into a lot of trouble right now. What I'm about to say is, why do people bet with these things when you can go on betting exchanges?
Because that's how they run. It's too easy to kind of bookies on the street, and you know.
Right. That's right.
Me and you could have a long conversation about
exactly. Probably not podcastable. But to answer your question about the sponsorship thing and the loopholes, I'll give my view on this just because I've talked to a lot of people about this, but I'm sure we all have here. UEFA insist that they're not stupid. Sheikh Mansour can't get his cat to sponsor Manchester City to the tune of 100 million euros a year. If he wants to do that, that won't count towards financial fair play. It's all written in the rules. And I don't think they haven't done a very good job at getting the message out to people, but that they're not fake. They have benchmarks. So I believe still the biggest sponsorship deal in the world is Barcelona, 30 million a year with the Qatari Foundation. Given that Barcelona are bigger than just about any other club in the world, if Manchester City come along and say, look, we've got a 50 million euro sponsorship, then UEFA will say, no, you don't. You have we're going to benchmark it at 20 million or 18 million or whatever it is. So they're actually very vigilant. And the way the rules are written, and you can actually download the entire PDF document and read this if you're sad like I am, or like Ollie, because I'm sure Ollie's actually read it as well. The entire Suarez judgment the day it came out, right?
But I'm not sad as you.
You can be sad if you download it, and you're even sadder if you believe it. Because what happened is the Barcelona benchmarks will take everything up higher, and all the big clubs, go towards that, they'll gravitate towards that, and all of a sudden it will seem reasonable that Manchester City, because they've won the title, they're competing in the Champions League, that will seem reasonable in the minds of UEFA that they get 100 million. Shared sponsorship and stadium sponsorship.
But it's not going to be 100 million. If Barcelona are getting 30 million, they're not going to allow City to get more than Barcelona.
Well, Barcelona are going to get more and more, aren't they? And wherever they push up at the ceiling, everyone else will follow.
Do you not think this could be challenged,
Gab? Well, it can be challenged.
That's the whole other issue, the legal aspect of it. We'll get to that in a minute. But so Tony's got no faith in the enforcement. Do you, Ollie?
Well, no, because realistic, who are you UEFA to say, that such a deal isn't worth anything to Etihad and Manchester City. If Etihad are using Manchester and their whole Manchester City thing as a vehicle for Abu Dhabi and for Etihad Airways, etc.,
I've been to City Manchester, not as many times as you. You look at their sponsors, and it's pretty hokey stuff, right?
Well, it was 2 years ago. It was about 6-8 million.
No. But it's hokey in the sense that they're brands that. I'm sorry, I don't live in Abu Dhabi. I don't, certainly, sure as hell don't holiday there. Why would I ever want to go on Etihad Airlines? Like, why do they need to advertise to me? Or the other one, that ABAR thing, or the Abu Dhabi Tourism Authority? Come on.
So you wait for going to sit there and make value judgments on.
If you read Annex 11 of the financial fair play rules, that is exactly what they're going to do. They're going to say, out of line with anything else.
It's a pile of boiled you-know-what. You'll drive a truck through it. The big clubs will drive a truck through it.
It's UEFA's competition. It's UEFA's rules. I mean, why does nobody have any faith whatsoever?
It's a European law. Do you not think that can be challenged?
Because realistically, they're not going to want a competition that is without the English champions if Manchester City remain the English champions. They are not going to want a competition.
You don't think they'd rather have Spurs in there than City?
Spurs wouldn't get through the qualifiers.
Obviously not. We have a question there in the back.
He's going to crack.
Can Man City pay Carlos Tevez, the player, $2 million a year, and then Carlos Tevez, the endorser of Etihad Airways, $12 million a year?
Again, theoretically, but again, UEFA say that they have looked at every single possibility, and they will rumble you if you go and try to do this. And
well, they've been so good in the past, haven't they? Because, you can't trust them.
They haven't had financial fair play rules in the past, have they? But I think
what we've seen an organisation that's shambolic to the point of being corrupt.
You're mixing UEFA and FIFA there, aren't you?
A lot of them. Football's ruling bodies, are just a mess. And if anyone expects credibility, decency, from UEFA's financial fair play.
I will tell you why I think, and Tony, I want to hear your view on this. I'll tell you why I think they will actually enforce the rules. And by the way, if you take the time to read it, look at Annex 11, one of the key points that they make is that they lay out all the rules and they say, oh, but ultimately, we reserve the right to change our opinion on this. And it's our judgment, it's our interpretation. And they make one important difference, is that you can lose 100 million this year. If you can prove to UEFA that you think you will make 100 million next year, they will allow it to go through. And ultimately, when you talk to these people, they say, we just want clubs moving in the right direction. Now, bear one thing in mind, though, Tony and others. There's a lot of very big football clubs who have lobbied very hard for financial fair play. If I'm Bayern Munich, if I'm Manchester United, if I'm making sacrifices to fulfill these regulations, and Manchester City drives a truck through them, I'm going to say, you know what? Screw you, Manchester City. Then you go play with yourself up by the City of Manchester Stadium. I'm leaving UEFA if they're not going to enforce their own rules. And I'm Bayern, and I'm United, and I'm Arsenal, and I'm all these virtuous big clubs. I don't need Manchester City and Chelsea and the rest of the Johnny-come-latelys.
Did you really say the phrase virtuous big clubs?
Well, virtuous in the sense that they make, that they're big profitable clubs.
No, just don't ever use the word.
But that's the whole thing. It's basically, you know, the bigger clubs, the established elite, effectively pulling up the drawbridge and trying to keep the.
But I'm saying, but we can't have the argument both ways. But we can't have it both ways. We can't blame the established elite from keeping the nouveau riche clubs out, while at the same time criticizing, saying, like, they're not going to enforce the rules properly, right?
No, but
it's going to be one or the other, right?
Well, it is, because that is the way the rules have been set up is wrong, because it basically prevents competition, it prevents sort of clubs living the dream, as Peter Ridsdale would say.
But it won't be one or the other. It'll be a fudge.
Hopefully that's the last Ridsdale reference of the evening. Tony.
There's the inside of the club and the outside of the club, OK? A few of the clubs I played for paid you in certain ways.
Cash.
No, cash. But they paid you in ways that they found loopholes to pay you different from the normal bog-standard contract. That still happens today. And you know that. You do know that, didn't you? Yes, you do. You know, so they find every avenue. They employ top lawyers, they employ top accountants to try and do. And you know, normally what you find is the guys that they're paid more than the guys who work for UEFA or FIFA. Mm. They're paid more because they employ the better ones, the clubs. Mm. So you normally find they're ahead of them, Gab. So, you know, you're saying that these guys are very intelligent, know what they're doing, and, you know, they understand the way clubs are trying to find these loopholes, but I just think the clubs are always ahead of them. On the inside, it's like that.
I mean, but ultimately, it's going to be, I think, an issue more for the revenue and stuff like that.
No, they're not. I got paid different ways from my contract, but paid my tax. And there are other clubs that have paid different ways, like obviously Rangers. They got in trouble. But there's many clubs who've done what Rangers did. Rangers are not the only one who did the way they, you know, paid players.
And we have to interrupt you here before Celtic fans get very angry.
What was the most bizarre way you got paid? I had Villa paid you in pigs.
there's ways of getting paid, but it's still legit, but it's a loophole.
Yeah.
And there are as many consultant payments, as the lad touched on there, that happen to put certain players and are still happening today.
We need to move on from this topic in a minute, but we have a question over here. Olivia, the gentleman in the...
Hiya, I just wanted to make a quick question to the panel. The financial fair play rule that we've been speaking about, do they not have that in any leagues globally? I'm sure I read that Germany or...
French league is very, very controlled.
Is the German league the same as well? I'm not sure.
German league is a license, as a different set of rules. Mm. They have a licensing system. It was kind of funny, actually. The Premier League basically doesn't have a licensing system at all, which is why you get these absurd situations. You get another club that nobody ever talks about, to the point that I'm wondering if there's a conspiracy where, like, you know, Phil Gartside has information on everybody. Bolton, they've got a debt that's, I believe, more than the turnover, and it's all owed to one guy who's supposedly a Bolton fan. And I never read anything about this, which I find absolutely hilarious. I can only conclude that it's because nobody really gives a hoot about Bolton. But you know, it's funny because I kind of feel like if this was United in that same situation, then they'd all be mobilized. But
isn't United that big of a turnover? It is.
Well, it is, but United are profitable. Bolton lose money every year.
I know, but whereas this guy, Eddie Davis, is a guy who has basically given the club a loan, interest-free loan, whatever, or is investing, putting his money into Bolton.
Is he?
Yeah, well, that's what he's done so far.
That's what they say he's done so far.
He hasn't yet pulled it out, right. Whereas the Glazers at United are taking money out. So
we don't need to ask questions because it's virtuous.
The Glazers, it's more virtuous than what the Glazers do.
I don't know. I mean, the Glazers are dishonest in what they do. You know, most of it all goes through the books. Football's the only business you can asset strip on an annual basis, and people come back for more.
Okay,
getting money out of the football.
We don't like to talk about that, and clubs' lawyers don't like to hear us talking about that. So let's stop it with this line of questions.
Come down, okay. See me. I'll sort them out.
On a very serious note, I think Tony's going to hang out for a while afterwards. He has all sorts of stories on the way that clubs and club owners take money out of clubs. And this is like a little aside here. You know, we always look at this and we say, like, these successful businessmen buy into clubs and they say, yes, I do it because I'm a fan. And, you know, I've lost $20 million, but I don't care because I'm just a huge Wigan fan. Oops, I shouldn't have mentioned any club. The reality is these people aren't stupid, except for certain individuals. I mean, obviously, people like Mansour are clearly throwing, I think, good money after bad. But the vast majority of these people, the reason there are still people who buy clubs in the Championship and in League One and the lower echelons of the Premier League, because there's about a bazillion different ways to get money out of a club.
And then what you can do, you can cry poverty, and you can say, and I put all my money in. And I tell you what, people are just ripping money out of clubs left, right, and centre.
I think we're going to move on now to our next topic. It's been suggested by Rob Yandel. Rob, are you with us?
Well, I'm not going to read out the question.
But basically, I just thought...
Particularly in England and in Italy, you've got so many teams and they're all growing in stature. So there has to be a credible alternative to the Champions League in terms of competition and revenue. And at the moment, there's such a disparity between the Champions League and the Europa League. Surely there has to be something that bridges that gap.
Ollie, a Europa League is a strange animal. They've centralised it. They've changed the format a little bit. And yet you still have people saying, no, it's a nuisance, blah, blah, blah. Is it all simply because they can't earn as much money as the Champions League?
Well,
or is there another problem with it?
One problem with it is it's interminable, isn't it? I mean, I think Fulham started in, what was it, early July last season. And
1941.
And in order to reach the final, they would have had to play something like 21 games, which is more than a league season in some countries. It's ludicrous, the format of it. It could be far more streamlined. And given the money that there is in the Champions League, it really should be something closer to that, because at the moment it's a disincentive almost to be involved. You only need to look at Tottenham's reaction to it, and you look at Aston Villa's reaction once they got to the quarterfinals or last 16, having expended an awful lot of energy and air miles getting to the last 16 or quarterfinals or whatever it was 3 years ago, and then they started playing the reserves because they thought it was their best chance of getting into the Champions League. It's just stupid. If you're in a competition like that, the goal should be to win it.
Well, it seems to me that it's just stupid decision by Aston Villa and their manager.
At that time, they were going for the top four. And his view, and it was a correct view, was that that they were running out of gas, having too many games, and they couldn't sustain the two things. And
maybe if only Randy Lerner had given him more money to spend
on squad players.
Exactly.
The Europa League, brought to you by the people who are going to bring you financial fair play. There's no point to it.
Before you go down this, people may not know this, but when Tony was younger than he is today, he used to follow his team around Europe. And while they played in the European Cup a lot, which probably should be a hint that he's not really a Manc, they also did play some in the UEFA Cup as well, as it was known then. Was it better than the Europa League is today? What can we do to go back to it?
Well, we can't, because when they widened the European Cup and made it the Champions League, and they let, you know, as many as four teams into it from one country, the whole point of the UEFA Cup, sort of disappears. I mean, when only champions went into the Champions Cup, then it was a coup to win the UEFA Cup.
Because it was probably a better competition than the European Cup.
And you felt the up-and-coming teams.
Which is why Liverpool won so many European Cups and not as many.
But now when people who are 5th, 6th and 7th are getting in, there's no incentive, and there's no incentive to watch it in terms of television money. They should scrap it. I mean, it's a flawed competition. No one wants to be in it. And, you know, there's no point in this anymore.
Any Fulham fans in here? Do you want to go and tell Mr. I think there's a microphone making its way over to you. Do you want to tell him how you felt? Was it pointless when you got to the Europa League final?
It was the best thing that happened to Fulham. It's never going to happen again. They played some amazing teams. Juventus win was amazing. I can understand what you're saying about the Champions League should only be two teams in the Champions League and then the next two should go into the Europa League, but... Mm. I don't think they're going to do that, so they should scrap it, you're right. But the Fulham, for me, it was brilliant.
Oh, yeah, and of course, the best thing in the world, you know what, finishing fourth, for a fan, I think it should be a pile of crap. Going to a final and winning, you know, even losing in a final is better than finishing fourth, as far as I'm concerned. 2001 in Dortmund was one of the great nights of my life. You know, it's just unbelievable. But you know what, you've created a situation where clubs don't want to win competitions and fans do, and you know it's. When the clubs are not interested, get rid.
We when I first moved over to France, we played the League Cup, and the incentives to be successful in the League Cup were huge, and I couldn't get the Cup de France was really tiny, and it was all about money. It was the fact that the league promoted so much for the League Cup, they give clubs huge amount of money to play the League Cup. So the competition became really important. Now we've seen these competitions, the Europa League, been devalued. That's what it comes down to. There is no financial gain for them.
I think you guys are all kind of, or in general, there is, I mean, all right, Europa League is what it is, but my personal two cents on this is, as somebody who doesn't just watch the English clubs in the Europa League, I think it's been fantastic. This year it's been a privilege to watch Athletic Bilbao. I think if City and United had gone on further the competition, I think everybody in this country might have been more lifted by it and felt more involved in it. It's not perfect. The prize money is growing, and I think that is a big part of it. But I don't know. I mean, we might just kind of get used to sort of Thursday nights watching the Europa League.
That's what it will come down to. It will come down to finance. Mm. If they promote it and they do prepare to pump into it, it will create.
Yeah, but they're not going to give money away. Like it has to be self-financing the way the Champions League is.
You know, managers are not leaving out players for any reason. They're leaving them out because there's a bigger pot. Treasure, and that was the Premiership trying to make top four.
I think we have a question back there, Olivia. Do we? I can't actually see you because you're behind the. Oh, there you go.
Sorry. Do you think that if UEFA adopted the same principle as in rugby, where the winners of the Amlin Cup go into the Heineken Cup the following year, so if the winners of the Europa League qualified for the Champions League, that would give it a higher profile and teams would get more behind it.
What is the strange language you speak?
Rugby, not a major sport on Merseyside. Ollie, you sound posher than he does, so I'm assuming you have more experience. You could address this question.
I think most people sound posher than Tony does. But I agree with Tony. I agree with the point, and I would also agree that it would be good in terms of the FA Cup if the FA Cup had had a spot for the Champions League rather than fourth place in the Premier League.
You'd have to do that with every cup in Europe.
I don't think you do, actually. I don't believe it would stop
cups being disregarded.
Why would England get special treatment if they had the winners of the FA Cup going to Champions
League? They don't get special treatment. I think UEFA, contrary to what people say, generally are fairly reasonable, and if a league came to them, I mean, if you recall, Wales for a long time, when they didn't even have a league, they used to send a team to the Cup Winners' Cup. Like me, Ollie's got... He remembers all these weirdo facts from the late 1980s. Mid-80s, there you go. I think if the Premier League went and said, you know what, UEFA, we want to give one spot, I don't think UEFA would have a problem with it. I really don't. And I don't think you'd have to make the same rule. I mean, the number of teams per country would remain the same. I could be wrong on this, but they kind of hinted to me that they are pretty reasonable when it comes to that. Yes?
Yeah, I'd just like to make a point. I don't think it's just relevant to the amount of money in the Champions League, but it's also relevant to the amount of money in the big leagues. Because while the teams in England, Italy, Real Madrid and Barcelona wouldn't take it seriously if they're in the Europa League, you then look at, obviously, Scotland, but also Holland, Portugal. These teams take it very, very seriously because that's the best they can get. Now, if you end up looking in England, you've got a team that will be trying for the next year to get in the Champions League. Would be more important than them having a run in Europa League that could then end up, they finish fifth because they play too many games.
Yeah, I've heard that argument. I think it's true to a point. I mean, Benfica were in the knockout stages of the Champions League this year. They were also embroiled in basically a three-way race to get in the top three in Portugal. And Portugal sent two teams to to the Champions League. So I think often it's kind of an excuse that sort of, you know, clubs like the one Skinner supports tend to make for why they go and play weirdos in the Europa League until they lose to Shamrock Rovers and stuff like that. But I'm not sure that that's, I mean, you'd have to look at it case by case empirically. Our next subject, next topic is one of our producer Chris Skinner's favorites. It's suggested by Neil Dorgan, and it's, what can we do about penalty kicks? Now, Seb Blatter, who of course is our spiritual guide and guru, he said recently that he doesn't quite like him, he finds them cruel, and I don't know, I was in Munich, Ollie, so were you. It did seem kind of, you know, is this, okay, I'll very rarely feel empathy with the Germans, but you did kind of see the point that they go and they batter Chelsea for 120 minutes and they lose on penalty kicks. Now, Neil has a suggestion. In a minute, I'm going to ask my own panel for what we can do if the scores are level after 120 minutes, yes?
Maybe not 120 minutes, maybe have 20 minutes extra time first, but then go down to seven players apiece. And then
or it's seven aside on a full pitch.
Seven aside on a full pitch. You're lots more extra space. You're guaranteeing goals.
That's your shot.
That's true, too.
Tony, so I'm going to go to you because I know you're probably slightly more traditionalist than the rest of us. When God created football, he didn't put grass in the sky, as Brian Clough famously pointed out, and he intended it to be 11v11. Is seven against seven men running around a giant pitch, is this what our maker intended?
I think rock, paper, scissors, that's the only way to go forward. But look, you know what? What's wrong with penalty kicks? Sympathy for Bayern Munich? I've got none. You know what? Score a goal in like 90 minutes or the extra time. Don't miss penalties in the game, and then you don't go to penalties. I don't see what's wrong with penalties. It's not cruel. Crap, mentally weak teams lose penalty shootouts.
I can confirm that, of course, Tony was there in Istanbul back in 2005. Ollie, do you have a better solution than Neil's? And if you don't, what do you think of Neil's solution?
I think Neil's solution would probably be abuse of human rights or something like that.
For reporters who run Deadline, because could you imagine that Deadline ticks away? I'm in the office screaming at him, "Filed now!"
No, but there was. I remember when I was very young, seeing there was the North American Soccer League that they did in America and Canada. They used to run from halfway with the ball. Rather,
Major League Soccer did this as well in their inaugural season.
So it was like a shootout, but you had to beat the keeper.
Whether
it was by dribbling around him or shooting. And I remember seeing this on something like Saint and Greavesy or whatever, back in the 80s, and it was fantastic. But it still comes down to the same principle of, you know,
although it kind of replicates real football slightly better than somebody taking a penalty.
That's the point. But I mean, penalties have just become an accepted part of it. I mean, we've had World Cup finals, you know, two I think of the last 20 years, 18 years.
Yeah, one of them we don't like to talk about.
Decided by penalty.
The other one was brilliant.
Four of the last ten years in the Champions League. So it's become part of football, and it probably shouldn't be.
It probably shouldn't be.
Well. The other,
to be fair, they've only been around for 40 or so years, haven't they?
What about the good old-fashioned replay?
I am a big fan of the replay for a World Cup final, for a Champions League final, possibly. After that, you get into major issues of fixture congestion. If it's around a 16 clash between between Benfica and Zenit St. Petersburg, is level over two legs, then
I can still remember seeing Liverpool lose as a kid on the toss of a coin at Anfield.
Yeah, well,
I can still remember missing in the third replay against Everton the year they won the cup, missing a one-on-one. After 100, there's a couple of Gillingham supporters over there, and they might remember that.
Yeah?
1-1 with 5 minutes to go in the third game.
I still have nightmares of that miss. But I watched the Sheffield United Huddersfield. That was the highlight of the game, the penalty shootout. Something that used to happen in training, and I tell you what, if you ever want to finish a game and you want to introduce a rule that totally opens up the game, don't have offside. Just say no offsides. Get a goal within 5 or 10
minutes. So, Cass, is that because that way you can take your large target man, have him stand on the keeper's head, and just keep booting the ball forward?
But I tell you, Gab, if you want to finish your game, no offsides, you'll be amazed. And tactics, all these teams will come up with great tactics about how to win the game.
Let's go the whole hug, no rules.
You can say it, but we need to get you a microphone.
Can I just say that, Tony, when you were playing for Gillingham, you assumed that rule had already been enforced.
I had nightmares with that miss.
Wait, was Andy Hessenthaler young when you were playing there?
He wasn't.
Or was he old? Was he always old?
No, yeah, he's younger than me, Andy.
Is he?
Yeah.
I think one of those guys was just born old. Do you have a better solution for, apart from the offside? Is this really your solution?
Abolish offside. The seven aside. Players are absolutely, if you watch extra time, they're out on their feet, aren't they? So reducing the number of players, I think, is a real problem because you're going to get injured players, that's for sure, if it goes on with any length of time. There isn't a great way. I do love dramatic penalty shootouts. I'm a bit where Tone's coming from because I just think, you know, it has to come to an end. I do agree with Gab as well. For how can you end a World Cup final really on a penalty shootout? I think that Champions League, I can understand the sense in that.
Crossbar challenge.
Yeah, crossbar challenge. Yeah.
Personally, I think I get to wrap this up. I'm with Ollie. I would. I think this is something that actually is fun to watch. Slightly better than penalties is the player running with the ball from. I think it's from the top of the D, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
You got 5 seconds to shoot on goal, and the goalkeeper can come out. You can do whatever you like. It is gimmicky, but so are penalty kicks, frankly. But more than that, I would have a replay for the World Cup final, for the European Championship final, Champions League final, and most of all, if teams finish level on points, because I don't believe in goal difference. I think it's something sick and stupid and twisted. But I know nobody agrees with me, so we'll just move on.
What about direct results during the course of the season?
That's even more idiotic. The point of the game is to get, in a league format, it's to get points. Two teams finish level on points, they're level on points. Simple as that. Why should results against somebody else determine anything?
No, sorry, direct results. It's having
what do you mean? Oh, wait, head-to-heads?
Yeah.
That's stupid, too. I like that. In Italy, until 4 years ago, we had a playoff if teams finished level on points, and I think that's the way it should be.
But it also implies that the teams are equally matched anyway, so why should you take notice of the results between the two? You should take notice of the results against everyone else's.
Or just send them off to play 90 minutes in a neutral venue, make the prices affordable to the fans, put it on live TV, and call it a celebration of football. Our final question on this topic.
What happens if you've got Everton and West Brom on 43 points apiece, and Liverpool is above them on 46, and Everton wins, and then you have Everton and Liverpool on 46 apiece?
Well, we should get the higher place just because.
Yeah, exactly. Aren't Everton the older club, shouldn't they?
Yeah. What, you know, they're more like a ugly, deformed older brother.
You know. Why do you keep in the attic and don't?
Exactly, right, exactly.
Like Thomas. Ollie?
No.
Well, it sounded like you were tempted to speak there, but.
No, look, I was just going to say that there's a situation in the Premier League where if teams finish level on points, goals difference, goals, etc., and it's first, second, third, fourth, fifth, or the bottom three, then there has to be a playoff because there's obviously financial and sort of prize money at stake, etc., or maybe even a prize. But I know this is very hypothetical, but had the Manchester Derby at the Old Trafford, which finished 6-1. Finished 2-1 this season.
Yes.
Then United. With the same results, everybody would have. City and United would have finished on exactly the same goals, points, etc. Mm. and then there would have been a playoff. Can you imagine that? That would have been
would that have been more exciting and better and more satisfying?
But
I don't think much could be more exciting, better and more satisfying than those last minutes of this season. I mean, you know what? You should be rewarded for scoring more goals.
Why?
Because that isn't the point of this game, to score goals. Otherwise, we're all Roy Hodgson.
All right, Skinner at the back is telling me to wrap up, which means we won't have time to get to topic five, will we, Skinner? Because that's a topic you didn't actually like. So tempted to read out and humiliate whoever submitted topic five, but I won't because that would make Skinner uncomfortable. We'll be back. And again, I should re-acknowledge and thank my panel, even though I'll be thanking them again later. So thank you, former Republic of Ireland striker Tony Cascarino. Thank you. Thank you. Was it brass player for the farm?
Trombone
player for the farm. Tony Evans. And if you follow him on Twitter and like time travel, you can see a picture of a young Tony Evans with his trombone. And Ollie, who of course was not a talented musician, but he is our number one football correspondent, Ollie Kay. Thank you.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.